Well, good afternoon and welcome. My name is Dean Reuter. I'm director of the Federalist Society's practice groups, and I'm happy to welcome you here today to our discussion on Christian Legal Society versus Martinez. I'm up here to introduce our moderator, but also to thank our co-sponsors for today's program, the Cato Institute and the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. Both organizations are well represented on our panel today. But let me now introduce and turn things over to our moderator. Bill Saunders is Senior Vice President and Senior Counsel at Americans United for Life. He is a graduate of Harvard Law School and was featured in Harvard's first Guide to Conservative Public Interest Law in 2004. And perhaps most importantly for us institutionally, he's chairman of the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Groups and a longtime member and supporter of the Society. So, Bill.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for coming. The great thing about this panel today is the timing, because we have oral arguments coming up on Monday, so this will get you ready for it. The case is described in the yellow handout there, and I'm certain you're all aware of it. So I will skip kind of a detailed description of the case and just introduce our speakers so we can get started. I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they're speaking. Probably they'll speak 8 to 10 minutes, and then we'll have a rebuttal among the speakers to the extent they want to. Then we'll open it up for you so we can get as many of your questions as possible. First speaker is Roger Pilon, who is the founder and director of Cato's Center for Constitutional Studies. He's the Kenneth Simon Chair in Constitutional Studies at Cato. As all these speakers, he writes frequently, is in the media frequently, press and print, broadcast and print. He holds a BA from Columbia University, a master's and a PhD from the University of Chicago, and a JD from George Washington University School of Law. Barry Lynn is an ordained minister of the United Church of Christ and executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He is he earned his law degree from Georgetown University and a theology degree from Boston University. Luke Goodrich is Deputy National Litigation Director at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty here in D.C. He specializes in federal appellate litigation involving the rights of religious groups. Before joining Beckett, he worked at Winston and Strawn and served as international legal advisor in the State Department's office concerned with human trafficking. He graduated summa cum laude from Wheaton College and a JD with high honors from University of Chicago. He clerked for Judge, now Professor Michael McConnell, on the Tenth Circuit. Paul Smith is partner in the litigation department of Jenner and Block. He has an active Supreme Court practice and has argued 13 cases before the court. He graduated with high honors from Amherst College and received a JD from Yale Law School, where he served as editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal. He was a law clerk for Judge James Oakes of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and then a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell. It's also interesting to note that he was named one of the decade's most influential lawyers by the National Law Journal in 2010. So first, please join me in welcoming our distinguished panel, and then Roger will speak.
Well, thank you very much, Bill, and for the purpose of those who are looking at this event on the tape, let me just say a bit about the case itself. This should have been an easy case for the court to have decided based upon the court's prior decisions and the first principles of the matter, but the district court completely botched the opinion in light of those two, and the Ninth Circuit simply rubber-stamped it, which doubtless is why the Supreme Court granted cert along with the merits of the matter. The case arises because Hastings Law School refused to allow the Christian Legal Society, a tiny group within the 1,400 or so students at Hastings Law, to become a registered organization and to avail itself of the various privileges that other organizations are able to enjoy and as recognized organizations at Hastings. In other words, in the name of anti-discrimination, Hastings, a government entity, discriminated against the Christian Legal Society, which was simply exercising its constitutionally protected rights of discriminatory freedom of association. So this case implicates rights of religion, rights of speech, rights of association, all of which, under past precedents, trump any non-discrimination interest that the law school would have under cases like Roberts v. J.C.'s and Dale v. Boy Scouts. Moreover, Hastings cannot evade the constitutional principles by saying that the Christian Legal Society is free to go elsewhere to exercise its rights. The doctrine of unconstitutional conditions blocks that tack. So what I'm going to do following that summary is give you a little more detail. I'm drawing from the brief that Richard Epstein wrote for the Cato Institute in this case, which is an extraordinarily compelling brief that I urge you to read for greater detail than I'm going to be able to give you in the few minutes that I have here this afternoon. Let's start with the first principles of the matter. And those are rooted, of course, in our founding documents, the Declaration, the Constitution's preamble, and they make it very clear that we start our legitimacy in the state of nature tradition stemming from Locke, indeed before that, stemming from the evolution of the common law over 500 years in England, whereby we ask, first of all, what our rights are vis-a-vis each other, and that enables us to derive government and its powers legitimately. And so when you do that, you find that our basic right is, as Locke put it, property broadly understood is lives, liberties, and estates. So liberty is the fundamental right there, including freedom of association. And there are two morally relevant ways in which we can associate, either voluntarily or by force or fraud. When people associate voluntarily, wealth is maximized because, of course, they would not do so unless each party could better his position by doing so. And freedom of association has two sides, however. It has, first of all, the right to associate with anyone who wants to associate with you as against third-party interference, and secondly, the right not to associate with those who you don't want to associate for any reason, good or bad, or no reason at all. So those are the two sides of the right to freedom of association, and it all reduces to the notion of sovereignty, individual sovereignty. And, of course, the principle applies equally to government, which, being owned by all of us, cannot discriminate except on grounds that are narrowly tailored to serve the functions of the organization. And so that's the conflict that is at issue in this case, the right to freedom of association of the individual and private organizations on one hand versus the right not to power to discriminate on the part of government on the other hand, except for narrowly tailored grounds. There are standard limitations to this right to freedom of association, of course. Coercion, cartelization, monopoly, health and safety are the cardinal among them. But short of those, freedom of association should have applied in all areas of life, economic as well as personal liberties. And, of course, it did, up until the New Deal constitutional revolution, apply largely to economic liberty, not so much, to be sure, in the area of personal liberties, as some of our more unfortunate history indicates. After the New Deal revolution, however, we had a flipping of those. Now we had freedom of association limited in economic areas, limited very severely, in fact, as time went on, and freedom of association with respect to personal liberties being protected in cases such as Griswold all the way to Lawrence, for example. Christian Legal Society claims, however, are clearly within the modern realm of protection of intimate association. Not that the court hasn't had a difficult time and had to engage in some questionable footwork to distinguish these two areas, economic liberty and personal liberty. Indeed, if you look at some of the cases, you will see that once you abandon the private-public distinction in this area, you have to do that kind of fancy footwork. Thus, for example, in the J.C.'s decision where the court found that public accommodation law did apply to the J.C.'s, what the court said is that it did so because of the role of such relationships in safe. The basic principle was the court has, and here I'm quoting from Roberts, the court has concluded that choices to enter into and maintain certain intimate human relationships must be secured against undue intrusion by the state because of the role of such relationships in safeguarding the individual freedom that is central to our constitutional scheme. But that didn't apply in the J.C.'s case because there you had the J.C.'s did not exhibit any of the characteristics of small cohesive groups like CLS that hold clear substantive commitments and beliefs. And so you've got this distinction here between large groups and small groups to start the argument off. It is a vague line, obviously nothing as clear as the old private-public distinction. And so what you do is when you get to cases like the Boy Scouts, you have the court there. Let's start with the New Jersey Supreme Court, which found against the Boy Scouts, arguing that the organization had not sufficiently personal or private to warrant constitutional protection under freedom of intimate association. The Supreme Court of the U.S. reversed 5-4, holding that the core moral commitments of Scout membership counted for more than size and diversity of its membership. And so what you've got here again is the court emphatically and repeatedly stated that the evaluation of the court's group's goals and purposes necessarily reside with the group itself. In other words, the court in the Boy Scout case, the Supreme Court, they gave the Scouts virtual carte blanche to define its own purposes. And having done so, it became clear that the groups like CLS enjoy strong associational speech rights, religious interests that are protected in intimate expression associations. But here's a point that Epstein makes that I want to drive home because it's very important. The dissent in Dale followed the line of the New Jersey Supreme Court, but even if its logic had prevailed in that case, this case should come out exactly as Dale did. The CLS chapter at Hastings is small and cohesive. It has no ambiguity about its meaning or purpose. It falls squarely within the class of intimate associations that every justice of this court recognized in Roberts and Dale. All right. So much for that. Now, if Hastings can't directly regulate CLS under prior court holdings, neither can it merely exclude CLS from Hastings, leaving CLS free to do whatever it wishes in private circumstances. In other words, we're now turning to the unconstitutional conditions aspect of this case. The government, of course, is a monopoly, and it has the power to tax, which are the two relevant criteria for invoking the unconstitutional conditions. As such, it can't use its police power to achieve indirectly what it can't achieve directly. For example, the court could not directly order a priest to turn his collar around, nor could it say you can drive on the road only if you turn your collar around or give up your Fourth Amendment rights and so forth. This is the classic unconstitutional conditions doctrine. The state can impose only those conditions that relate fairly directly to the government's legitimate ends or interests. With respect to open public forum, we look at cases like Hurley v. Irish American Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Group. That was the case in which the state of Massachusetts sought to impose its anti-discrimination law against the South Boston Allied War Veterans Council to require them to allow the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual group to participate in the parade. The Supreme Court found against the state in that, and it did so on the grounds that the group was trying to impose its view on the the Veterans Parade. But even when you turn to a limited public forum, because Hastings' position is highly viewpoint sensitive, it cannot succeed. As a government entity, once it opens its doors to one category of emittees, it must be open to all members of the category. This, of course, is the Rosenberger decision, whereby the University of Virginia subsidized the publication of various organizations that participated in the school, including the gay and lesbian organization, but refused to do so for a group of Christian students. And so what you've got here is a case that cannot pass the Rosenberger test. Hastings, in response, offers no compelling justification. So what we have here at the end of the day is a blatant case of government discrimination in the name of anti-discrimination. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, I find a lot of the general principles that Rogers just articulated to be very, very compelling. However, most of them have absolutely nothing to do with the CLS case before the court to be argued on Monday. This case is really not about associational rights. It's not about government censorship. It's not even about the free exercise of religion. It is actually much simpler than that, and that is why the trial court and then the Ninth Circuit reached the correct, reasonable, and simple resolution of this case prior to it getting into this posture. The Christian Legal Society at the Hastings College of Law is not the subject of any discrimination. Moreover, it's not being forced to do anything at all. CLS can meet on the campus. It can even discriminate on the campus. It just can't get certain subsidies if it chooses to do so. And those principal subsidies, of course, are being funded by the student fees and also getting some kind of official designation, as in being considered the Hastings Law School Christian Legal Society. What this case is about is merely whether, as part of the educational mission of Hastings, it can preclude clubs that do discriminate on any basis from obtaining these important subsidies. And the answer to that must be, yes, it can make such a decision. There's no student organization at Hastings that gets these benefits if it discriminates on any basis, including status or beliefs. That's how I read the stipulation of facts to which both parties initially agreed before the trial began, and I think notwithstanding some of the new arguments that are being raised by CLS, that stipulation still holds water. I'm also not here, by the way, to defend the wisdom of the policy. I'm not sure that an all-comers policy is the soundest one. However, it's not unreasonable or otherwise unconstitutional. If there were an Earth First radical environmental group at the Hastings campus seeking funds and official designation, it could not discriminate on the basis of gender or race or religion or sexual orientation. Nor could it even condition membership on agreeing to specific principles under the policy of the university. If a university student believes that we should log the California redwoods but still wants to join Earth First, he or she must be admitted, just like all the other club members would then be, of course, permitted subsequently to chastise that person or ridicule him or even seek to convert him to some kind of tree-hugging ideology. Not that, of course, I think there's anything wrong with that ideology. Hastings' policy is strictly viewpoint neutral. Every group seeking official status and funding is prohibited from discriminating, and they're to do so based on a quite noble and indeed constitutionally permissible goal of enhancing a legitimate educational mission of Hastings. Clearly, the Hastings Law School sees part of its mission as the eradication of discrimination, and it provides for extracurricular activities in no small measure because it believes that those can enhance the purely academic experience in achieving that very goal of ending discrimination. The Supreme Court's made it clear in its prior decisions that educational institutions have the ability to craft reasonable, viewpoint-neutral rules about its programs, including student-initiated activities. Therefore, it would be very strange to effectively compel the university to grant funding and lend its imprimatur to discrimination when you allow a group like the Christian Legal Society to meet on campus, as is permissible, no matter what their policy is, it gives only the barest appearance of being some kind of official approval. But once you utilize the school name or share in the mandatory student fees, that becomes a direct facilitation and promotion of those ideas, something that Hastings is not required to do. I noticed in the briefs that CLS gives very, very limited reference to any effort to distinguish its own religious and ideological exclusions from discrimination based on gender or race. And I think I understand why they spend so little time on it. It's simply because there's no way to seriously draw a distinction. If the Christian Legal Society can say no to the membership of unrepentant gays, presumably there's a list of those people somewhere, and to Buddhists, then why couldn't the would-be Hastings chapter of the Christian Knights of the Ku Klux Klan say that based on their own theological beliefs, we will exercise them to exclude African Americans and Catholics to membership? I doubt that there's any libertarian, including Roger, who is the clearest, purest libertarian I know, would want to have the state entangled with making decisions about which religious beliefs are sincere enough or scripturally sound enough to get a pass from the otherwise applicable open membership policy of the school. What Hastings Law School has done is to create a limited open forum with reasonable ground rules, that is to say, reasonable conditions, not what Roger calls unconstitutional conditions. There are rules in addition to the rule against non-discrimination, and this is important. Groups cannot have a commercial purpose, thus there will be no Amway Club at Hastings Law School. They have to be student-oriented and indeed include only students, thus failing to subsidize the mothers or fathers of law students' club if that wanted some kind of organizational support. The organizational system that they've created at Hastings is a limited forum. It is not an extracurricular version of a city park. It's not literally open to everybody for any reason. And I'd note that even in the case of something like the Boston Common, a quintessential city park, you may be able to advocate anything that you want, but the city is not obligated to pay for your megaphone to do so, no more than Hastings has to pay for CLS programs. Some people may say, look, this kind of non-discrimination is not a reasonable goal. We've passed this. We don't need to worry about it. But I think particularly in regard to graduate education, there's a long history of discrimination based on a number of factors, including religion, that need to be taken into account. There were, in graduate education programs up through the 1960s, quotas, including Jewish quotas in admissions. There were eating clubs that didn't admit Catholics that all helped to create a kind of old boys Protestant network that still has an impact on our culture, including our legal culture today. Hastings is being responsive to that history, and it shouldn't be at all embarrassed about taking a position that says we're going to do everything possible to prevent the possible recurrence of this discrimination at the graduate level. A lot of the briefs in this case in support of CLS also allege this right of association and interference with it, the right to free exercise of religion. I think neither of those arguments holds water here, and I'm sure that Paul will discuss these in more detail in a couple of minutes. There is no abridgment of free association rights because there is no association that's being forced on the Christian Legal Society. The failure to receive modest funding is far too attenuated to justify the claim that it inhibits some real and cognizable associational right. Similarly, there's no effort to target any religious group, including the Christian Legal Society, for any kind of unfavorable treatment. Even some marginal disparate effect on this Christian group is not sufficient to create a free exercise violation, at least in the view of this Supreme Court, and by that I mean everyone from Justice Stevens to Justice Scalia. George Washington, in an early letter, noted that this new nation of ours would give to bigotry no sanction. And whether the exclusion of non-Christians or members of the unrepentant portion of the LGBT community is seen as bigotry or just sound, principled belief, it cannot be given sanction by government, and it certainly cannot be given a dime of student funds. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here on such a fine panel. At issue in this case is the right of expressive groups like CLS to choose members and leaders who agree with their core beliefs. I think everyone on this panel, the Reverend Lynn included, agree that all expressive groups have this right to some degree. For example, if the government literally forced CLS by means of an injunction or court order to have an atheist president, that would plainly violate the Constitution under Boy Scouts of America versus Dale. Same is true if the government forced a Democratic group to have Republican leaders or forced a pro-choice group to have pro-life leaders. Groups can't survive if the government can force them to take unwanted members and leaders. But the university says this case is different because it's not forcing CLS to do anything. It's merely denied CLS recognition. And what this means is basically CLS can't compete with other student groups on the same terms. It can't reserve rooms on the same terms. It can't use email lists to contact students. It can't be in newsletters to inform students about their events. It's basically silenced. But the university says it's merely attaching strings to a government benefit, and it gives CLS a choice. Either accept the strings and lose control over who gets to be a member and a leader, or just give up the right to be a recognized student group. The question then becomes, when is the government allowed to force groups to choose between an important government benefit and a constitutional right? What kind of justification does the government have to give? And you're going to hear two intermingled justifications, but they're different. One, which you've heard from the Reverend Lynn, is that CLS is doing something wrong. It's discriminating on the basis of religion and sexual orientation, and the government doesn't have to support discrimination. The second justification you'll hear, which was in Mr. Smith's brief, is that it's not that CLS is doing something wrong, it's just that the university wants to ensure that all students have access to all groups. I'll address both of these arguments in turn. First, is CLS doing something wrong? There are two candidates, discriminating on the basis of religion or discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation. Is it wrong for a religious group to discriminate on the basis of religion? That should be an easy question. If a Jewish synagogue has to hire a Muslim rabbi, it ceases to be a Jewish synagogue. If a Christian church has to hire an atheist pastor, it's not a Christian church. Religious groups simply become all bland interfaith societies. And it might be nice to have interfaith societies, but it's also nice to have distinctive religious groups. Not surprisingly, every state in the country not only protects but supports this right. Any state statute that forbids discrimination on the basis of religion, sensibly, without exception, includes an exception for religious groups. Similarly, the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that religious groups have a constitutional right to choose their members and leaders on the basis of religion. Second candidate, is CLS doing something wrong by discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation? A few responses here. First, a clarification. CLS has no policy whatsoever on sexual orientation. What it has is a comprehensive moral code, like many religious groups do. One part of that moral code applies to human sexuality, and CLS says that anyone who engages in sexual conduct outside the bounds of traditional marriage is doing something wrong, whether you're homosexual, heterosexual, bisexual, or something else. It applies to everybody equally. But it doesn't just apply to sex. You can lose your CLS membership over lots of things. Repeatedly and unrepentantly lying, cheating, stealing, drunkenness. Any of those can be grounds for revocation of membership if you're doing that unrepentantly and not admitting that you're, and not trying to change. So what CLS is doing here has nothing to do with sexual orientation, has everything to do with ensuring that its members and leaders abide by its moral or behavioral code. Is that wrong? That should be an easy question too. Every group on Hastings campus is allowed to enforce a behavioral code. For example, if a vegetarian student group could revoke the membership of students who hold a big meat barbecue, a pro-choice student group can tell its members and leaders, you're not allowed to go picket in front of abortion clinics. And similarly, Hastings Outlaw, which Mr. Smith represents, gay student group, has in its charter, its constitution, says it can kick out any leaders who work against the purposes of the group. So every other group is allowed on Hastings campus to enforce behavioral standards, except CLS. CLS is just asking for the same treatment. Not surprisingly, here again, states and the federal government uniformly protect the right of religious groups to enforce their moral codes. Look at every state law, as CLS brief points out. Every state law that prohibits sexual orientation discrimination includes an exemption, some sort of exemption for religious groups. The point is that religious groups have a very important interest in ensuring that their members and leaders adhere to their moral standards, including sexual conduct standards. But say you disagree with me. Say you think CLS is doing something evil by requiring its members and leaders to abide by a moral code. For example, it might disproportionately affect gay and lesbian students, and you think that's wrong. I have a question for you. Do you really want to empower the government to choose which groups get constitutional rights based on whether the government thinks the group is doing something wrong? In the 70s and the 80s, there was a string of cases involving gay student groups at universities. The universities denied recognition. They said, our state law says homosexual conduct is illegal. It was criminal in many states. And they said, we're not going to recognize any student group that facilitates illegal conduct. What do you think the court did with those policies? Struck them down uniformly, and rightly so. Now the shoe is on the other foot. The only question is, will CLS and other religious groups get the same rights that gay and lesbian student groups have gotten across the country? I think everybody should have the rights. What do you guys think? Barry made the point about race, which I wasn't going to address because it's so easy. And that's the reason why none of the briefs address it. It's because race is different. We fought a civil war over race. We had enslavery over race. We had a civil rights struggle over race. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that nothing the government does can compare with its interest in eradicating race discrimination. So of course the government can prohibit groups from excluding students with no reason on the basis of race. But the same government interest isn't even close to there when it's sexual orientation, religion, or even gender. That brings me to the second basic alleged justification for why the government can exclude CLS. This one doesn't claim that CLS has done something wrong. It says the university is just trying to increase access for student groups. It says all student groups have to allow all students to become members and leaders. It's not about conduct, it's about access. Now you'll notice they vacillate between these two and basically say that this access thing is really about eradicating discrimination. But that's neither here nor there. Two responses why this argument fails. First, it's not about access at all. CLS already lets every student attend every event it puts on. Atheists can join in and participate in Bible studies. Gay and lesbians can come to CLS dinners, and they're welcome at every single function. What Hastings wants, what the university wants, the government university, is not just to have atheists participating in Bible studies. It wants atheists to be leading Bible studies. Now, what possible purpose could be served by having this sort of a policy? Barry said he's not here to defend the wisdom of the policy. Will anybody? I don't think Paul will. Maybe he will. There's only two options. One of two things are going to happen. My guess, most likely, atheists aren't banging down the door to join CLS. Meat eaters aren't banging down the door to join the student vegetarian group. In that case, this policy is purely symbolic. It doesn't do anything. Nobody uses it. The other option is that hostile students do want to join these student groups. And why do they want to join them? To undermine them or destroy them. In that case, the policy is quite effective, but its only effect is to destroy student groups. Calm down. That might explain why no university in the country has adopted a policy like this, and why Hastings, the university, has never enforced it against any student group in the history of the university, except CLS. The second problem with this argument is that this policy isn't neutral at all. It systematically disfavors unpopular and minority groups. If a group of students doesn't like one of these small groups, they can just show up, vote themselves into leadership, and destroy the group. Large and popular groups are not subject to takeover like that. More importantly, this rule stifles diversity. Hastings says it's trying to promote diversity, but when you force diversity within groups, you actually destroy diversity among groups. The policy has a homogenizing effect. Every group starts to look like the majority ideology, and you lose any distinctiveness. If you really want to promote diversity, you protect the right of groups to form around whatever viewpoint, code of conduct, or beliefs they want. So in conclusion, if this is not about access, what is this case about? This case is about the university wanting to send a message that it disapproves of CLS's beliefs toward homosexual conduct. I quote from their brief, "The policy ensures that the school's facilities and own name are not used to support groups that choose to engage in conduct that the school or the state of California do not wish to lend their name to." The policy is about disapproving of CLS's beliefs about homosexual conduct. Now, I don't mind if the university wants to send this message. The university can send whatever message it wants, but the Constitution limits how it can send the message. The university could have a gay pride parade every month of the year. The university could have an anti-homophobia campaign. But what the university can't do, and what it's done here, is create a forum for the exercise of constitutional rights, allowing student groups to engage in speech. And then it's yanked the rug out from one participant in that forum that it disapproves of. That's viewpoint discrimination, and that's plainly unconstitutional.
Hi, it's nice to be here. I think I'll try to keep this a little bit short since I'm going fourth, and I think that we want to get to the conversation part of the event. As Luke indicated, I represent the intervener in the case, the gay student group called Hastings Outlaw, and so we're respondent in the case. And as a representative of a student group, obviously we strongly support the notion that there is such a thing as a right of expressive association. And that it would be violated if a university, a public university, or any other organ of government said to an expressive association, "You can't form it. We're going to tell you who you have to allow to join, and the government's going to decide that instead of the private organization." And so, to use the Luke Goodrich formulation, we don't see this as a case about CLS doing something wrong. We see this as a case about an organization that's exercising its constitutional rights, the rights recognized in the Dale case, for example, to decide who you want to have in your association based on their beliefs. But what's different about this case, and certainly different from Dale, is that it's not a case about the government telling any organization what to do. It's a case about a law school deciding what category of student organizations it wants to subsidize and give official recognition to. And that makes a very important difference as a matter of constitutional law. There are, of course, some limitations, constitutional limitations, on what conditions can be put on a stream of funding of this kind or a recognition of this kind. But it's not true that a university has to treat that as if it was simply the equivalent of banning the organization. There are many conditions on funding which are not unconstitutional conditions but are instead constitutional conditions. The government does it all the time. And the test for deciding in this context whether or not it's a constitutional condition or unconstitutional condition is essentially, is it viewpoint neutral? Are they treating people differently based on their point of view? And we've certainly heard many arguments this afternoon already that suggest that it is, but it's perfectly plainly not. The policy, whether you think it's a good policy or a bad policy, applies equally to everyone. The all-comers policy says, in order to be into this group of organizations over here that we're going to subsidize, you have to have adopted a policy that allows anybody who's a member of the student body to join your organization and compete for leadership. It doesn't say you have to make anybody a leader. They're allowed to to be eligible for leadership if the organization so chooses. Now, the reasons that are articulated for that by the law school are that it promotes communication within the organizations instead of having people be walled off into separate organizations where they are only with people they agree with, and also that the money for this comes from the students and that they think it's a better way to run the show to have students who are paying the money in be able to participate in all the activities that their money is supporting. You may agree with that or you may disagree with that, but it strikes me as not a particularly serious constitutional issue when you treat all organizations the same, and all organizations at Hastings who choose not to follow that model, and they are perfectly free as American citizens to form any other way that they want to. They can, and they have, there is no banning of organizations on this campus in the way that you saw, for example, in the Healy versus James case. That's the sort of opposite model. This was a case involving the Students for Democratic Society back in the 60s. College decided, we don't like you because of your viewpoint, and we're going to not only not recognize you, when you try to meet in the student coffee shop, we're going to come in and run you out. You're not allowed to be on this campus. Now, that's the analogy that's constantly being drawn in this case to this policy, and it's just a completely inapt analogy. The college Democrats, the law school Democrats, are treated exactly the same way by this policy as CLS is. If they don't want to let in a Republican into their membership and have them eligible for leadership, they don't get recognition and they don't get funding. So the unwillingness to subsidize organizations that don't comply with the all-comers policy has nothing to do with religion in particular, or CLS in particular. And the idea that this policy has not been enforced in the past is an interesting one, because there's no indication that any organization has ever violated the policy in the past. So that is the stipulated record on which this case will be decided by the Supreme Court. We see a great deal of effort in Judge McConnell's brief to try to re-argue the facts, having petitioned for cert and told the court that the facts are undisputed. We have a reply brief raising issues of pretext and all sorts of factual disputes, leading me to wonder whether this case will ever actually be decided on the merits by the court. But that is the case as it came to the court, and that is the case that was decided in the lower courts. Perfectly consistently applied policy, equally applicable to everybody. Now, what's really going on in this case? Why is this case getting so much attention? It's not as if I think that the world would be a terrible place if law schools couldn't have this policy and had to subsidize organizations that get to decide who they want to have as their members. This is not the First Amendment issue of all time. But what we're doing right now in this country is we're in the process of drawing a very difficult line between permissible and impermissible discrimination, non-discrimination requirements that are perceived by people as interfering with their free exercise of religion. And this is coming up in case after case in lots of different contexts. We've had, for example, the Benitez case in the California Supreme Court last year, where a doctor working for Kaiser Permanente wouldn't treat a lesbian. And the court ultimately decided that if you're going to go into the business of being a doctor and offer services, it's perfectly constitutional for us to tell you you're not allowed to invoke your religious beliefs as a basis to discriminate. That's, I think, an easy case on the side of upholding the discrimination requirements. Similar one would be if you operate a hotel, you can't suddenly say we don't want Jews in our hotel because we're a Christian hotel. On the other hand, obviously churches and prayer groups and all kinds of other organizations not only can but should discriminate on the basis of religious beliefs if they want to. That's their First Amendment right. And I am a very strong believer in the First Amendment right. In fact, I would argue that racists have a First Amendment right to form a club of racists and exclude black people. The First Amendment should protect that. But there are difficult lines, places in that spectrum where there's not an easy case on one side or the other. And so this case is, I think, largely being used as a way to slightly push the line in favor of greater leeway for claims of religious exemption against the claims of being able to apply discrimination requirements involving sexual orientation in particular. And so, you know, whichever way it comes out is probably not going to push that line very much one way or the other, but it is a skirmish in this long-running battle of trying to create more space to discriminate against gay people primarily on the basis of religion, which is being fought out in lots of different places. And, you know, ultimately we will end up with a set of rules where that line will be kind of difficult to draw. Clearly business will be over here and social groups will be over here, but there are cases in between. Like, for example, religiously operated charities. What are the rules that apply to them? Can they invoke the First Amendment to discriminate if they want to? That sort of thing. So that's ultimately sort of the background issue that is going on in this case, as we argue that the doctrinal issues about how you think about the unconstitutional conditions doctrine and the public forum doctrine. And with that, I think I'll turn it back to the moderator.
Just we're getting down to about 35 minutes left, but I want to give each of the panelists an opportunity to briefly respond to something another panelist may have said, and then we'll open it up for questions. Roger?
Sure. Let me begin with a brief response to something Paul said and then save most of my fire for Barry. Paul said that this case has nothing to do with religion. Well, it does, because religion is what defines CLS. And the court in Dale was very clear about that, that it defers to the organization's assessment of its own character. In fact, the court emphatically and repeatedly stated that the evaluation of a group's goals and purposes necessarily reside with the group itself. It was deferential to the Boy Scouts in that case, and I predict it will be deferential to CLS in this case. Now, let me turn to Barry, because he said that this, too, is not about association. Just as Paul said, it's not about religion. I thought it was about both. The CLS is not the subject of discrimination. It's just that the CLS can't get subsidies. Well, the problem is that the court has already, or excuse me, Hastings has already made inroads on that, because Hastings has said that it will allow CLS to have space. It's just that it can't get some of the other privileges. Well, now it's just picking and choosing on the things that it's prepared to give. In other words, it's saying that we can't totally exclude CLS from the premises because of CLS refusal to follow the non-discrimination policy. That's constitutionally indefensible. But we can refuse to give them subsidies. Well, the problem there is that now you're up against equal protection, because the members of CLS and their families are taxpayers, just like the other students and their parents in the association. And so, therefore, what you've got to do under the Equal Protection Clause is treat all equally. You can't start discriminating on the basis of your subsidizing religion, not when you're in an unconstitutional conditions context. Barry said that the school does not want to give the CLS its imprimatur. That is simply a red herring. Anytime government allows its forum to be open to all, or to those who fit the conditions that it cannot invoke, it is not tantamount to giving its imprimatur. Does the government, in allowing the Nazis to march in Skokie, give its imprimatur to the Nazis for that? I mean, after all, this is stretching entanglement beyond anything that is remotely reasonable. Now, finally, Barry said that no association is being forced on CLS. Well, it is, because what Hastings is saying is let anyone join CLS or you get no benefits. That's the very essence of unconstitutional conditions. I mean, it's no different than the mugger. The mugger says your money or your life. You say, I've got a right to both. And the mugger says, well, you're not going to have both. Hastings is here in the position of the mugger. Run your organization as you want, or get subsidies, which you're otherwise entitled to. Well, you can't have both. This is the classic case of unconstitutional conditions, and I submit that the court is going to decide it as such. What you say, Barry?
I was going to hold the fire on you and apply it to Luke. But no, let me say just a couple things about what you just said. Let me stand firmly against mugging. I'm against that. I'll stand firmly in support of something Luke said in a second.
But you're not. That's just the point.
No, but you know, what this is a society, though, where an extracurricular policy has been adopted that essentially says if you're in a student group, no matter which one, we're going to mug you equally. That's the difference. There's no specific reference to CLS in any of these policies or in the practice. In other words, this is a neutrally applied policy, and except for this raising these new facts in the reply brief that Judge McConnell presented, I thought these issues were firmly resolved, that we were not going to relitigate, and certainly not do it at the Supreme Court, litigate questions about whether anyone else ever suffered the indignity of having to follow the policy. So the policy is universally applied. Let me just move this forward. On Luke's question, the other thing I want to stand firmly in support of is I do not believe that churches, including churches in the United Church of Christ, in which I am a minister, should be required to hire atheists as pastors. I want to affirm that. Luckily, because those Christian churches do not receive any subsidy of any kind from government, or at least didn't until we had that giant faith-based initiative created in the last administration and continued in this one, those subsidies were not present. And it strikes me that that makes a huge constitutional difference played out in this way and in cases involving the faith-based initiative around the country. They can't be forced to take an atheist pastor or an atheist organist, for that matter, because they are not subsidized in any way. That's important, because here the question is, can you discriminate on the basis of religion, among other things, and accept the subsidy? Frankly, Luke, I don't think the race issue is resolved by simply saying it's so obvious the court will always gives deference to race. I can't believe that it's your position that the free exercise of religion is always trumped by any claim of racial equality. But that's where you go if you accept that this is so simple and you don't have to deal with the very real issue of very real and existing organizations recognized as religious organizations by this Supreme Court, like the Ku Klux Klan. Remember the case of Panett, where they wanted to put up a cross, and the court basically said, look, they say they're religious. We accept that. It's not an easy question, and it's not one to be disposed of in this way. And finally, I think, Luke, you're coming dangerously close to making this argument that the reason this is viewpoint discrimination is because the viewpoint that the Christian Legal Society has is we want to discriminate. Other people don't, but we want to discriminate. And that becomes a very circular argument, which would require a change in the whole civil rights rubric of the country. You could have people say, well, we don't serve African Americans dinners here at the barbecue pit, but since it's our opinion that we shouldn't have to, we win. That can't be correct, because government must be able to regulate that kind of conduct, and presumably will, even when this court gets finished with doing whatever damage it chooses to do to the Commerce Clause.
A couple quick points. Barry says that churches don't receive subsidies, but they receive subsidies all the time. 501c3 tax-exempt status is a massive subsidy. You could characterize fire and police protection as a subsidy. So the question is, what exactly is the subsidy? And certainly the government couldn't condition tax-exempt status on saying religious groups have to refrain from discriminating on the basis of gender. So, Catholic Church, you're not tax-exempt because you don't allow priests, females to be priests. That would be plainly unconstitutional. So the question is, what kind of subsidy are we dealing with? And here it's not about money at all. The vast majority of this subsidy consists of access to the channels of communication on campus. It's access to a student email list. It's being able to reserve a room for speakers. It's being able to advertise your events on student newsletters. So basically, the university is giving a megaphone to every other student group and not even giving CLS a microphone. And funding is a tiny part of this speech forum. But the only purpose of the funding is to facilitate speech. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, Rosenberger is the chief example, that when the government doles out funding specifically for speech, it's treated just like, you know, the government doling out sidewalks or access to a park. It's just the funding isn't anything other than a channel for speech. And in that case, it's subject to heightened restrictions. And then finally, the idea that this policy is neutral, and there's Mr. Smith said there's no indication that any organization has violated the policy on the facts. CLS cited, I think, 5 or 6 constitutions of student organizations in this case. Every single one of them said you can't be a member or you can't be a leader in this organization if you don't agree with our beliefs or if you work against the purposes of the group. So the reason, you know, we're vacillating and struggling, is this about discrimination or is it an equal access policy? It's because when the university first denied CLS recognition, it said, we're denying you recognition because you're discriminating. That's how it started litigating this case. Only after it became apparent that they would lose badly on that theory, in the middle of the case, they developed this equal access policy. It's not written down anywhere. It came up in the deposition testimony of one of the university officials. And it's never been applied against any group. It's shown to be pretextual because Hastings allowed all these organizations to have these constitutions saying, we'll exclude you if you disagree with us. But it never kicked out any of those groups. It only kicked out CLS. That's why it's viewpoint discrimination.
Couple quick things. On this issue of what's pretextual, I think it's important to understand that the facts as they were agreed to and litigated below show that while there were some bylaws that contained restrictions of various kinds, they were not allowed to be effective. When La Raza had such a bylaw, they were told they had to change it. This policy is this notion of pretext, which has appeared in the reply brief on the merits of the Supreme Court case, is quite bizarre. And I think what it reflects is ultimately, if everybody's treated the same under the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, public forum doctrine, it is difficult to make a constitutional argument. Now, one thing I will say, I agree with Roger and disagree with Barry on one thing. I do think, to the extent that Barry was suggesting, there's something wrong with having the alternative policy, which allows organizations to restrict membership based on their beliefs and treat all of them the same and have money flowing to those student organizations. That in that kind of situation, that there's something wrong with that if it includes religious organizations. I think it's very clear, Rosenberger stands for this, that the state can do that as well, and that as long as religion is treated the same as non-religious groups, their speech is equally valuable, and they get that's okay. And indeed, that's what this case is ultimately. It's that they're treated the same. And the argument is ultimately a claim for a special treatment for religion. It's sort of ironic given some of the rhetoric that goes around in other issues about special rights versus equal rights. But it is, in fact, a claim for to be treated differently from other organizations that is being litigated here, not a claim for equality.
Okie dokie. Thank you very much. Questions? Oh, and we have a microphone. Okay.
Hello. Matt Bowman from ADF. This case was debated at Roger Williams Law School last week. A student.
Sorry, Matt, but if there's a particular person you want to answer, you know, designate them. Otherwise, anybody on the panel can answer.
Probably Mr. Smith. A student got up from the Alliance Gay Rights Organization, said that they rented a bus to go to Maine during the last election cycle to take students to advocate in favor of the right to same-sex marriage. A condition getting on their bus was that you agreed with them on the issue. I'm wondering how you think that would come out under the Hastings policy and under the Constitution.
Well, I don't know how it would come out under the Hastings policy. The Hastings policy has to do with membership in organizations, and it probably could be viewed as an instance of belief-based discrimination to get on the – if you think getting on the bus is equivalent to that. The Hastings policy is that Hastings Outlaw has to let – people who are homophobic come to their meetings and join their organization, and that's the rules that Hastings Outlaw lives by. So that may seem like an unusual way to run the railroad. There are plenty of schools that don't have such a rule, probably a large majority. But the question is ultimately whether it's constitutional to have such a rule and subject everybody to the same rule.
Is Roger Williams private or public?
I don't actually know. But assuming that
if it's a private school, it should be able to discriminate as it wishes.
My question was how it would go in a public university under a Hastings-type policy.
Okay, go ahead.
My name is Stephen Shore. Two brief questions to anyone who chooses to answer. We've assumed, although no one, I don't recall anyone explicitly saying this, that Hastings is a state school, and my argument would be, would anyone's position change if Hastings were private? And secondly, same-sex marriage is currently illegal in California, but let's suppose it were legal, would there be a claim of discrimination against the unmarried, or would the issue not even have reached litigation because with the legality of same-sex marriage, then members in theory could be members of the group without violating its policy, provided they were married?
I'll address the first of those questions. I did mention at the outset that Hastings was a government entity. It probably does not like to think of itself as such, but that's what it is. And as such, it cannot rightly discriminate except on grounds that are narrowly tailored to serve its function. And if it's going to open, as in Rosenberger, the forum, a limited public forum, it's got to be open to all. If it were private, it would cut just the other way, in my judgment, not under state or federal anti-discrimination laws at the present time. And there is the great problem, because we find ourselves having abandoned the private-public distinction in favor of the large-small, as was the case in JCs and Boy Scouts. And then in Boy Scouts, they changed it from large, because Boy Scouts is large, to intimate versus non-intimate. Now you find the courts scrambling to try to draw lines that are really not there to be drawn. And so when Barry raised the point that we want to discriminate, how did he put it? An organization that says we want to discriminate, if you allow that, it would raise serious problems with our whole anti-discrimination law. Yes, it would, because our whole anti-discrimination law, in abandoning the private-public distinction, has opened itself up to drawing these fine lines and to the kind of subjectivity that necessarily follows, such that you get the New Jersey Supreme Court going one way and the Supreme Court of the U.S. going 5-4 the other way, because we're drawing nothing but value distinctions.
Anybody else on that?
I can briefly address your second question. My understanding is that CLS doesn't view same-sex marriage as valid, regardless of what the state thinks about that issue. So their rule would be the same. You can't engage in sexual conduct outside a male-female marriage. And if the state were banning them because of that belief, it simply backs up the discrimination. Rather than banning CLS because you don't like their view of homosexual conduct, you're banning CLS because you don't like their view of marriage. Either one is unconstitutional.
Okay. Okay, back over there.
This is for the panel. In CLS versus Walker, which is the circuit split case, Judge Sykes spent about half of her opinion explaining why she didn't think the CLS chapter at SIU Carbondale was engaging in sexual orientation discrimination because their policy was just flat, nothing outside of marriage, whether it's homosexual or heterosexual. Do you think any of the justices might take that theme up when they decide the case?
No. I don't think this is going to rest on that question. And I have to say, with all due respect to the word banning, nobody's banning CLS. No one's even banning CLS from meeting on campus and having a discriminatory, terrible policy. We're talking about something entirely different.
Nick, anybody else? Okay, yeah, please.
I have a quick question. Earlier it was discussed about where funding was going, and that seems to be the major issue, is whether or not the students are paying a fee, an activities fee, that then is distributed among the organizations. My question is that my high school has the same thing. We pay an activities fee every year, and that goes to any organization that helps to pay for if we want to pass out flyers. It goes to pay for the use of the building. It goes to pay for that sort of thing. If CLS isn't allowed to be recognized, then they are being barred from using those services. Does that mean then that the school will turn around and then can charge them for using those services, which then adds to the, which would then add to making one specific organization pay for those, whereas the members' fees are used to support other organizations that they don't personally support. Like if they had a pro-life or a pro-choice organization, I don't support pro-choice. My tuition, then, that I'm paying is going to support that organization. what then is the decision?
That was decided in Rosenberger, in Lamb's Chapel, in Widmar. I mean, the court has been pretty clear on that.
Well, the court's been clear in Rosenberger, which I don't think was properly decided. But let's say assume. Well, no, wait a minute. That's okay. But just a few moments ago, you suggested I was right about the unraveling of the whole civil rights rubric of America. But we're talking about the U.S. Constitution, not the Cato Land Constitution. I like that. You know, I'm a big fan of Cato, but you're just wrong about this issue. But I think to go back to this question, I think a lot would depend on the treatment that is given to other groups that are not student subsidized. I think there's a very strong argument to be made that we should that institutions, including universities and high schools, should not have these subsidies of student groups across the board because of the very argument that you make. But that's not the case that the court's dealing with on Monday.
Well, that's exactly right. It should not. But if it does, it's got to be open to one and all.
Yeah, that's what it is here. One and all, except unless you unless you discriminate, or you're a commercial entity, or you're a club that's not just for students. There's three conditions, not a one of which is unconstitutional.
Well, the question is, what is it about CLS that is the discrimination against CLS that is consistent with the mission of Hastings?
Doing away with discriminatory treatment. And to the extent that this is a group that says we want to maintain an organization that, forget the issue of gay-straight, the question, we want to limit this to people of a certain religious belief system, that is called discrimination.
Well, that's one reading of the mission of Hastings. Another reading could be promotion of freedom of association.
Well, it could be, but it doesn't happen to be the principle articulated by Hastings. I mean, you can come up with a whole lot of policies, and as I suggested, I can just say it. I mean, I can think of a lot of better policies, but this is the one we're dealing with and the one that the court needs to deal with.
Well, then this is a matter of positive law, and you seem to be saying that whatever it is that Hastings comes up with as a matter of positive law, as its mission, will pass constitutional muster,
No. And
that will not fail.
No, I'm just saying that you, sir, you have not made an argument that, per se, this policy violates the Constitution. I mean, you can make it. I don't think there's any
substance. I've made several arguments to that effect. You didn't hear them.
Well, no, I did. I listened with great care. That's why I said that so many of your principles are right, just not applicable in this matter.
Either of you two want to get in on this? Any other questions? Any other questions? Are you asking? Go ahead.
This question is for Mr. Smith. I'm interested if you can maybe work out for me a little bit more. I'm failing to understand the distinction, or I'm not hearing a distinction in what you're saying. So you say that this policy is viewpoint neutral, to support which you then claim that it's uniformly applied. I don't think I don't understand how those are the same thing. And let me posit a hypothetical to sort of work that out a little bit. Reverend Lynn has been talking about the fact that Hastings sort of stands for, as a government institution, the obliteration of discrimination. As a government entity, we could posit that perhaps they're also in favor of, for example, representative government, right? So they could make a universally applicable policy that, in addition to not discriminating on the basis of sex or race or religion or sexual orientation, that you also couldn't discriminate on the basis of, non-discrimination, I guess, isn't applicable because we're talking about the all-comers policy, that there's some aspect having to do with belief in representative government, et cetera. So then let's say you have an organization that that would want to be, you know, contra to that in some way, that you want to a monarchist society or whatever. So can you exclude that society because you exclude everyone who doesn't agree with representative government? In other words, just because it's uniformly applied, does that make it viewpoint neutral?
No, it doesn't. But if it's viewpoint neutral and it's uniformly applied, then it is different from a rule that says we're going to fund everything except this viewpoint. That you can't do. I mean, even if you apply that rule to everybody, it's unconstitutional. In the First Amendment, the government can't decide to pick and choose among points of view which ones to subsidize in a situation of this kind. That's the Healy case, where they didn't want the Students for Democratic Society to get treated the same as everybody else just because they didn't like their views. And so obviously uniform application of a discriminatory rule, it doesn't make it any better. It's still discriminatory. All I'm saying is that's not what this case is. The facts of this case are that the rule has nothing to do with what your belief system is. It has to do with what your membership policies are. And that is the distinction that we've been talking about today. So.
Lady in the front here, yeah. No, first and then, yeah.
This is really quick, but just to follow up on something you just said, isn't a membership...
It's like being an oral argument.
I know, sorry. But isn't, in this case, the membership policy is based on viewpoint. So if you say the discrimination isn't based on viewpoint, it's only based on membership policy, but I think the membership policy and the viewpoint is so intertwined that I don't know how you can separate those two.
Well, but if you have a policy that says the Republicans and the Democrats and the Buddhists and the Christians and every other organization, the vegetarians, they all have to let every student in the school come to their meetings and join their organization, then how can you say it's against Christian viewpoint? It's just not. That's just, you know, that's like Orwellian or something. I mean, it just doesn't scan.
What it ends up being against is against minority and unpopular viewpoints because it systematically disfavors those viewpoints because if students don't like the Christian group or the gay group, you know, it might be the Bible Belt doesn't like the gay group, and the Christians show up and join the gay group. That's going to harm the gay group because they're unpopular. Here, San Francisco, the Christian group's not that popular, so they're the ones that get harmed. It doesn't end up being viewpoint neutral. And moreover, you keep saying that it's purely neutral, but the university is hard to pin down on this. They keep making exceptions to this unwritten policy that they've made up. They've said that you can have conduct rules, so you can exclude people if they don't pay dues. They've also said you can have merit-based membership rules. So law review, of course, doesn't take all comers. You got to write on or have good grades. Now, what if CLS wants to say, we're going to have a comparative test of religious orthodoxy, and whoever passes the test gets to be a member? Other groups can have tests for membership. Why can't CLS?
Because it's a question of, under the policy, there's a distinction between a law review, which everybody's eligible to compete for, and a religious organization that says if you don't have the statement of faith, you're being excluded because of your beliefs. You know, whether that's good policy or not, it's not what I'm here to defend.
Everybody's eligible, under my hypothetical, everybody's eligible to compete for CLS. You can all take the religious orthodoxy test.
Well, is it a test of just knowledge like or a test of beliefs? Is it a test of knowledge or a test of beliefs? If it's a test of beliefs, like do you believe in Jesus Christ as our Savior, then calling it a test and comparing it to the law review is silly. It's a question of belief. That's a different thing.
No, Paul, it's a question of the criteria for membership and who gets to set that criteria, the organization or the school.
It's a question of the criteria for funding and who gets to decide what they want to subsidize and what kind of a line did they draw.
Once they open the door, they have to open to all comers.
Please, so every government funding stream has to go to everybody regardless of what the purpose of it is?
That is the criteria they set out have to be neutral. They can't be viewpoint discriminatory.
Completely agree with that.
And for the point that this young woman just raised is absolutely correct. The very idea of the view that is being discriminated against is the religious idea. The organization is religious, therefore, if you're going and therefore exclusionary. If you're going to discriminate against exclusionary groups, then you're going to discriminate ipso facto against religious groups.
Roger, would you disagree with your colleague Luke on the question of the Christian Knights of the Ku Klux Klan? Should they be able? Notwithstanding your general distaste for the civil rights rubric of the country. But I mean, forget that. Under current law,
that was a low blow.
No, I'm just kidding.
And gratuitous.
That was totally gratuitous, and that's of course why I introduced it. But yeah. No, but tell me, what do you think? Here's the group, the Christian Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. They do want to bar African Americans from membership. Luke said, "Well, that's different." Do you think it's different?
I do not think it's different, and both members at Hastings can associate for that reason. But I don't think you're going to find many, many members at the law school at Hastings who will be in that organization. But I agree, they should be able to do so. And that brings us to the problem that you alluded to, namely that our civil rights law will unzip if we start drawing these fine distinctions. That's what the court today is faced with. I mean, the distinction between the JCs and the Boy Scouts is one about which there may be a dime's worth of difference, but only a dime. And so this is the, you know, this is what we've come to in the post-New Deal world, which you so love.
I wish I could find it more frequently than I see it, even here in this administration.
Fine. What? What's the it?
The post-New Deal world.
Oh. Yeah.
You're surrounded by it.
Not here, I'm not.
My name is Lindsay Hoven. I'm with the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, and my question is for Reverend Lynn. And on one hand, you say that it's perfectly legitimate for churches to discriminate in terms of hiring priests or pastors. And then on the other hand, you equate sexual orientation discrimination with racism. And there's a Supreme Court case, I believe it involves Bob Jones University, where the court held that tax-exempt status for a religious organization could be revoked because they had racist policies. And if these two are indeed synonymous, racism and sexual orientation discrimination, what happens to churches that refuse to hire a gay priest?
Or universities that have, say, a private university that gets government funds but has a policy saying you can't engage in extramarital sex or homosexual conduct?
Either or. I think there is a line yet to be drawn on what is a very, very important question. I'm sorry I can't see you, but a very important question about to the degree to which race is separate. And we've seen that Roger says that there's really no difference in many ways. That Luke says there is a difference. I think I would concur that there is some difference, but I do think that ultimately you couldn't make a constitutional case today to eliminate tax exemption for a church or a university on the basis of the way in which it did hiring of lesbians and gays and bisexuals in this culture. I mean, I don't think I could seriously say that the law leads us to that conclusion. There is some difference which the courts still recognize. Whether that will be true 50 or 100 years from now, I don't know, but certainly it is today. There is some distinction. It's just not the radical distinction that Luke was suggesting in his opening remarks.
And should it make that distinction?
I think it probably should make that distinction, but in a way that would be far less extreme than it would be permitted to make today. I'd like us to see moving in that direction, but with a deep and abiding respect for the fact that there are religious institutions whose interests are legitimate. It's just that the claim made by CLS in this case, whether it's about other religions or whether it's about gay or other conduct, is illegitimate in the context of funding.
We're just about out of time. I just want to give the panelists, I don't know if anybody wants to say a last word or two. If you do, now's your chance. You're okay? You're okay, Barry? Luke? Paul?
Pretty much covered it.
Okay, everybody. Help me thank the panel.